Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I recently got a chance to sit down with Jamal Joseph at the City Lit Festival at the Enoch Pratt Free Library. Jamal Joseph is a former Black Panther and is an associate professor and former chair of Columbia University's Graduate Film Division and the artistic director of the New Heritage Theater in Harlem. Early this year, he published a memoir called Panther Baby. Let's just take a step backwards. I think that for people who... How many of you read this book or know this book at all? A few. Okay. Once you hear this, you will read it, I think. Jamal Joseph was 15 years old when he joined the Panthers in New York. Let's just take a step backwards and talk a bit about that particular period, that what drove you from this time of living with your with the Baltimores.
The Baltimores. That's right. Those were my adoptive grandparents, Charles and Jesse May Baltimore. And he probably got that name because he was the son of slaves. And at that time, people got names. Sometimes it was the master's name that might have been the last place his family was, but that was Pa Baltimore.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It could have been descendants of slaves of Lord Baltimore.
Right, exactly. Right? That's right.
But so you grew up. Your life started. You were born in Cuba.
No, I was conceived in Cuba,
born here.
Conceived in Cuba, and then born in New York when my mother, who was a graduate student at the University of Havana, came home after the semester was over, after the school was over, and explained to my grandmother, A, that she was pregnant, and that when they asked who the father was, that he was a consort of the Communist Party and hanging out with people like Fidel and Raul Castro. I doubt if Mom got to finish that sentence before they had her on the first thing smoking to New York. They wanted to get her as far away from that as he could, and so I was actually born in New York City and raised in New York City.
And then tell us about how you weren't raised by your mom. You were raised by...
I was raised by adopted grandparents. So Mom had been in graduate school, pre-med student in Cuba, grew up speaking Spanish but also spoke French. But when she got to New York in 1952, she was a brown-skinned woman who couldn't speak English. So none of her training and education meant anything. She stayed with an aunt who she just didn't get along with. And so as soon as I was born, she said, I have to find some foster care and I have to start my education and my life over. So I was 17 days old, and I was put in the care of the Baltimores, who became my adopted grandparents.
And they, even though some, maybe you might argue, as you did in the book, that maybe you were genetically prone to become a revolutionary.
Exactly.
That also was the Baltimores, and it was their influence. They were Garveyites.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned earlier, their older siblings and their parents had been slaves. So they grew up in the South that was highly segregated and highly dangerous to be a person of color in. I mean, it's the South where... when you walk down the street, you didn't look, if you were black, you didn't look a white person in the eye. And if there was a narrow sidewalk, you cleared the sidewalk, or probably you just cleared the sidewalk. So that meant if you were an 80-year-old black great-grandmother and it was raining and a 15-year-old white boy was walking down the street, it just meant that grandma's shoes were getting muddy that day. That's right. The kind of South. But they were activists. They had been Garveyites. They had been active in local political organizations. Even though they weren't highly educated in terms of formal education, they were very well read and very knowledgeable. So I grew up kind of in that atmosphere. In fact, a story that I like to tell is sitting with Grandpa Baltimore watching television. And this is where I first learned to become critical of media. All right. And so his critique was like this. So you have to picture Grandma's old black and white TV and a Tarzan movie on. You all know the old Tarzan, Johnny Weissmuller movies. And Grandpa's sitting there, and he's in his 80s, and he's kind of half watching the TV. I'm doing homework. Johnny Weissmuller swings across the screen and does the Tarzan yell. And, you know, the elephants obey, and the lions obey, and the tigers obey. And the Africans are kind of sitting off in the corner, you know, huddled by a tree, looking scared and ignorant. And he watches it for about 5 minutes, and he goes, now what the F is that? He said, boy, tell me what the F is that. Little cracker baby fall out the damn plane. He speak lion, monkey, every damn thing. Africans look like they're crazy. Change the damn channel. So that was my critique on cinema and race and class in cinema. I then flipped the TV because in those days, those of you that remember, you were the remote control, right? Grandpa said, change the channel. You got up and you flipped the dial. So I flipped the dials, and here comes a young reporter named Harry Reasoner.
It's a great story.
This is before Harry Reasoner's great fame, but this is my first encounter with this form of journalism known as the editorial. Harry Reasoner is sitting behind a desk. He's doing an editorial. It was about the race for space. At that time, it was who was going to get there first. I think the Russians had put up a satellite before anybody else, which was a horrifying thing in terms of, you know, global politics and the race for power. And he lets Mr. Reasoner go on for about 3 minutes. I think he made it about 30 seconds longer than Tarzan did. And he talks to the TV, interactive. If anybody's ever been to Magic Johnson Theater, you know, black people's experience with media is interactive. And he then speaks to Mr. Reason. He goes, you as a lion, MF, onion head, frying pass place, MF and cracker, boy, change the channel. So I learned to question the editorial. But that was what, but I also learned from him to be proud. I also learned, he's the first person that I heard say that we were African. This is at a time in the black community where there was a great debate if we were Negro or colored.
Right.
And this was a time in the black community, this just before the black power movement, civil rights movement was going, but people would play the dozens. In other words, you would tease people, your classmates in school, by saying how black you were, right? Oh, yeah, your mama's so black, she went to night school and got marked absent, you know. And then you come back, oh, yeah, your daddy's so black, he sweat chocolate syrup, you know, so this was a thing. In the 20s, there was a song that was a big hit, and it became like an anthem for what it meant to be a person of color in America. If you're white, you just write. If you're brown, stick around. If you're black, you get back.
If you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh, brother, get back, get back, get back. I was in a place.
So overcoming that, overcoming the embarrassment of color, and overcoming the fear of being out of place, of speaking up too much, of doing too many things, was very much kind of part of the psyche that I grew up with. So having people like the Baltimores that would talk about the Ku Klux Klan, that would talk about the murder of Emmett Till, show me those photos and say what a horrible thing this is, and this is what you're going to have to fight against. And someone who could cuss out the TV, but in a way that was conscious about race and class, was a tremendous thing. I didn't realize it so much then, but as I got older, even as a man-child in the Panthers, I realized what a tremendous experience it was growing up with the Baltimores.
So the Panthers, you're here, you're 15 years old, and because these two older guys who you knew from this Order of the Feather, which you can describe in brief, you went to the Panthers. You wanted to be a Panther, really badly. Let's set the tone. The tone of that time, because a lot of people here who probably have heard the word Panthers, no idea what that moment was like in history. Some people were not alive then, or maybe were just being born. And so set the tone. Set what was happening to you, to the black community, why you were driven to the Panthers. What was going on that they became the central force
for
change?
Well, what the black community was very conscious of is that people were fighting for change. And the symbol of that change was Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement. So we understood about Rosa Parks. We understood about the civil rights protesting and the Freedom Riders. The black community was watching that very, very carefully. And if you lived in the North, you watched it. And if you had an opportunity to participate like I did, it was usually through the church and through the local church, Trinity Baptist Church. I joined the NAACP Youth Council. So students who were Freedom Riders would come and talk about their experiences. We collected money. We collected books. We collected food to send down. And then in 1968, April 4th, 1968, Dr. King was assassinated. And this just created a consciousness shift in the whole community. And for me, I remember sneaking down to Harlem and weaving in and out of the riots. In fact, almost, you know, being arrested and almost, being shot as I ran away from the cops and being protected by some men I later came to know who were Panthers. They were just these militant men that stood up to the cops and protected me. And I you would hear on the news, and you would hear people talk about this other force in social change, these men and women that were known as black militants. There was a coolness to them, too, because they wore afros and they had on sunglasses and they would wear army fatigue jackets and they would call, you know, they would call Whitey the man or the beast. They would just, you know, stood up in a real kind of cool and strong and almost arrogant way. And I remember coming to school the day after the riots, deciding and announcing to all of my friends that I ate lunch with. There was a group of friends that that we had shared the same table. We were hallway monitors, so we would eat and then go out into the hallway early. And I announced to my friends the day after Dr. King was killed that I, Eddie Joseph, I didn't have the name Jamal then, was going to be a black militant. And one of my friends, one of my best friends, was a white kid, a Jewish kid named Paul. And Paul looked and he said, "Eddie, I don't know if you can announce you're going to be a black militant like it's a career choice. Like you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer." And I was like, "No, Paul, you watch. You watch. I'm going to be a militant." And so I then had to prove to my to Paul as much as to myself that I was going to be a militant. And there on the news was a story about the Panthers. And the Panthers had organized 2 years earlier in Oakland, California, and they began patrolling the streets with shotguns and law books. And it was legal to carry guns in California if you didn't have a criminal record and if they weren't concealed. Any citizen could carry a rifle or a shotgun. And the law books were to let the police know and to let people know that they had a constitutional right to be treated a certain way, to be treated with a certain due process when they were arrested. In Oakland, in Harlem, in Chicago, in most black communities, it was standard procedure that if the cops stopped you or arrested you, that you were going to get beat up. I mean, it was just standard. As a little kid, I grew up with that reality. I remember sneaking over the fence to a park that was closed and playing basketball with my friends when I was around 10 or 11 years old. A couple of white cops came in. "What are you doing in the park?" "We're just playing basketball." "What are your names?" We gave our names. "Get the hell out of here." And to make their point, the cops took their nightsticks out and they whipped us across our back and our legs. We are running. We look over my friend Roger as we get around the corner and catch our breath, and he's crying. And guess what our reaction was? We teased him. We laughed at him. "Oh, you a punk. You can't take it." We didn't realize. We had been so socialized that this was a way of life in the black community that we thought crying because a cop beat us, by the way, an adult assaulted us, a person whose job it was to protect us had broken the law, it never processed on that level. It processed on the level that you a punk. You cried because that cop hit you. "No, I'm not." And that's how we process it. The Panthers helped us process that much differently. That not only was this against the law, that we were going to use the law to defend ourselves because you had a constitutional right for self-defense. So cops would pull someone over, throw someone against the wall. Panthers would be there. They'd stand the legal distance away, and they would read from the law books. They would read the person their rights, and they would also let the cops know that they had a constitutional right to observe, to defend themselves, to be on the scene. Would follow that person to the precinct. They would bail them out if they had the money. And if not, there were a number of young lawyers on standby, black, white lawyers, law students who would be there to represent folks. Well, anyway, the Panthers stormed the state capitol in Sacramento because the legislature decided when we said citizens could carry guns, we didn't mean black militants talking about revolution. And the Panthers responded by storming the state capitol of Sacramento. And I remember watching TV thinking, "They're crazy. They have guns. They got leather coats. They're crazy." And then Bobby Seale gave that great statement, you know, talking about self-defense and revolution. "He's talking about revolution. He's crazy." And then a news reporter said that they had stopped a Panther vehicle and they found more guns than communist literature in the trunk. I was like, they're crazy. They got leather coats. They got guns. They're talking about revolution. They got communist literature in the trunk. I want to join them, you know, because when you're 15, because that was the most militant scene.
We feel that the only way that Huey can really be taken out of the hands of those who are relentlessly trying to kill him, you see, is for the people become aware of what this is all about. If the people have to stand up and demand, and they have to understand that they have a right. They have a right to demand that these judicial procedures be carried out in the right manner.
The revolution has come.
Off the pay.
It's time to pick up the gun.
Off the pay.
The revolution has come.
Off the pay.
It's time to pick up the gun.
Off the pay.
Rode out to Brooklyn. There wasn't a Panther office in the Bronx or Harlem. And as we're riding out, my friends who were older than me were telling me, as far as they knew, we didn't really know, as far as they knew what it would take to be a Panther. One friend leans over, he says, yo, Eddie, you know the Panthers is like a mafia. You know, once you join, there's no getting out. And I'm 15 years old. I'm with two older guys. I can't be a punk. I'm scared, like the mafia. But I say, I don't care. You know, I can't be a punk. One guy leans over. He says, yo, man, you know you're going to have to kill a white dude to be a Panther. I'm like, kill somebody? But I can't be a punk in front of my boys. I go, I don't care. Other guy leans over. He says, no, man, get it right. Get it right. You ain't got to kill a white dude. Oh, my God, I'm so relieved. He was like, no, man, get it right. You got to kill a white cop. And you got to bring in his badge and his gun. So I am trembling when I walk into the Panther office. Is that Black Panther Party sign. We go in, I sit in the back, and the person is sitting at the front of the office, and he's explaining the Panther 10-point program. And if you look it up online, it's still dynamic and sadly still could have been written not 46 right. years ago, but last week. We want freedom, we want power to determine the destiny of our community, full employment for our people, decent housing, fit for shelter, human beings. Nothing in there about killing anybody, let alone a white cop. But I'm not kind of hearing this. I'm still, you know, having the inner monologue. I'm showing my friends I'm not a punk. I'm a man. He gets to point number five, which is about education. When education that teaches us our true history and the true nature of this decadent American society. And I jump up in the back of the meeting. I was like, choose me, brother. Arm me. I kill a white dude right now. The whole meeting stops. The man in charge says, come here, young brother. And I walk around to the desk, and I'm standing there, and he reaches down into the bottom drawer, and he's fishing around for something. And my heart is pounding in my little skinny chest. I was looking, look how far down he's reaching. He's going to give me a big damn gun. And he hands me a stack of books. Autobiography of Malcolm X, Wretched of the Earth by Fanon, Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver. Those of us from the 60s remember the famous little red book, Quotations for Chairman. Now I'm thinking this must be a test because my friends told me I have to do this and I have to do that. And so I said, excuse me, brother. I thought you were going to arm me. And he said, excuse me, young brother. I just did.
So, this is an important juncture here because I think that there are a lot of people who look at the Panthers and look at that period, the Panthers as they hear about free breakfast programs, and they hear about killing pigs,
right,
and calling police pigs, you know, and you see a cop, don't oink at me, all that went on.
Mm-hmm.
And those two polls, on some levels, were real. The breakfast program was real. That happened every day.
That happened every day.
Every day, feeding kids in the community. But people don't realize, what I'd like you to describe, is I would like you to describe what you learned and how it opened your eyes about what it meant to be a revolutionary in 1968 in the black world, and it was also not necessarily a black nationalist world. It was a very complex place.
Well, the second thing that happened, I mean, the thing that happened immediately following me getting the books was as I was walking back to my seat, the young lieutenant in charge said, let me ask you a question since you came in here mad, talking about you want to kill white folks. He said, if all of the cops in the community, these racist pig police that are out here, that are beating people up, brutalizing them, shooting them down, locking them up. If they were black and the people being brutalized were white, if all of these stores that are owned in the community that are ripping people off with high prices, spoiled vegetables, rotten meat, if all of the owners were black and the people being ripped off were white, And he said, and all these jive-time, demagogic, fascist, pig politicians, he said, if everybody in power was black and the people being exploited and oppressed were white, would that make things correct? And then I answered with my brain instead of now my well-bruised ego. And I said, no, sir, it seems like it would still be wrong. And for the first time he smiled, he said, that's right. This is a class struggle for human rights, not just a race struggle for civil rights. Study the book so you know what the revolution is about. And then, just a little while later, I was looking at the posters that were in the Panther office, and I was struck by the poster of Che Guevara. And it had a picture of Che giving a speech, and it was a quote from a speech that he had given a few years earlier at the United Nations. And the quote was, at the risk of sounding ridiculous, let me say that revolutionaries are guided by great feelings of love. And so that became clear the very first day. And then that weekend, I went to the first Panther rally, and Panthers would come out, and they would say, all power to the people. And people would say, power to the people. And they would say, that means black power for black people. And we're like pumping up fists, and we go, yeah, we get that. He says, that means white power for white people. And it means brown power for brown people, and red power for red people, and yellow power for yellow people. And we would go, well, what is that about? And they would break down what was happening in terms of class and oppression. What was happening with capitalism oppression? Why it was important for the Black Liberation Movement to be linked up with the labor movement and with the women's movement? And this is some heavy ideas and some bold ideas, but some very liberating ideas to get when you're 15 years old. To put the history of everything that was going on in the context, not just of race, but in terms of race and economics. So you began to understand that slavery was a business. You know, we grew up just thinking white people didn't like us. And then in a Panther PE class, you begin to understand that it was a business. In fact, the first slaves
political
were white.
Political education class.
Political education class.
Not phys ed, right?
Yeah. Political education, yeah. PE class, as we called it. That slavery was a business. Indentured service, and then Native American people, and then African people. And that racism is the ideology of oppression. It's how the people who were the marketers, the architects of the slave trade, marketed slavery to people that might have thought slavery was wrong. So you come on the auction block and you have these slaves you need to sell, and you have some people in the audience who are doubters who might be white. That's your audience. That's your target marketplace. So how do you deal with that? You said, good people, let me tell you what you're nervous about. You're nervous because the Bible, the good book, says that it's wrong for one man to enslave another man. And I'm here to tell you that I read the good book as well. And guess what? These African slaves you see behind me are not human. So you're not breaking any law, not man's law, not God's law. In fact, owning a slave is like owning a horse or a donkey or a chicken. It will help you prosper. And that's what the good book wants us to do. It wants us to work hard and prosper. So the byproducts of that, of an economic system that says that it's okay to keep people in chains for profit, is the attitudes of race that we have. And by the way, that continue to exist now when we look at class division, when we look at poor folk who might be black, looking at poor folk who are Mexican, looking at poor folk who are white, and all hating each other because they're saying, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have a job. If it wasn't for them working cheap, I wouldn't have this. Instead of asking the bigger questions, how come the stock market is posting record profits and people are living at levels of record suffering?
So when you became 15 and became a Panther, you became a revolutionary, and in a little bit we'll get into what that means for today, because you've never given up being a revolutionary, but we'll talk a little bit about what the switch was.
Sure.
But here you were in the Panthers. And that's another picture I want to paint. You had these lessons. You met a lot of very powerful people, Fanny Shakur, the mother of Tupac Shakur, and others in that movement, Lumumba Shakur.
Tupac, who was your student.
We have to give
props to that, because a life-changing experience for Tupac in terms of who he became as an artist happened when he got to the city of Baltimore and happened when he was in your class and you were teaching him acting and Shakespeare. Tupac would always say, in the midst of his stardom, right, and his, you know, his the thug life and all that movement, when he would talk about acting, something else would come over him. And he says, if you haven't really trained as an actor, if you haven't done the scene work, if you haven't done Shakespeare, you're not an actor. Now what? You know, so that was Pac.
Tupac was a good actor.
So we want to give him a round of applause for his role in Tupac.
Please.
We could do that.
So you met all these people. And one of the people you met was Idwa
Yewa,
who was this militant, crazy Negro, as they would say back in the day, Vietnam vet, who taught you guns, taught everybody how to use the guns, had you blindfolded so you could take them apart, put them back together again, because guns were very much part of Panther culture in terms of self-defense. Not in terms of being aggressive, going out and killing people, but in terms of self-defense. But this guy became very influential in your life.
He
for
did.
A period.
He did, and also understand. I had no that Pa Baltimore had. I never knew my father, never met him. Pa Baltimore was my grandfather, and he had died 3 years earlier. So I'm this 15-year-old kid who was in search of manhood as much, probably even more so than the movement. It just so happened that my search for manhood took me to the movement. We have a lot of kids who search for manhood may take them to a street corner or to a gang. It took me to the Panther Party. And here was this handsome, charismatic, crazy guy, but crazy in the black community is like a compliment. When you go like, oh, man, that dude is crazy, that means that he will lay it down. He will fight for you, for himself, for everyone else. And became my mentor. He was my section leader, which was like my lieutenant, kept an eye on me, made sure that I learned the self-defense and all of that stuff, but that I showed up at the breakfast program on time, flipped pancakes, did all of that stuff, even the right way to rap to a Panther girl, you know? Panther girl came to me once I began to feel my swag a little bit. I saw a young woman in the Panthers that was a little bit older than me, and I was like, what's happening, baby? And she spun and looked at me, and she said, the revolution is happening, my brother, and my name is not Baby. Boom! He was like, Jamal, you can't talk to a Panther woman like that. You've got to say power to the people, my sister. And when she says, how you doing, my brother, you have to say, well, my sister, you know, I'm really exhausted. I was up at 5 o'clock this morning at the breakfast program. Then I was at my school organizing. Then I went to PE class. Then I went out and I did community patrol. I could barely keep my eyes open, but I'm here, my sister. That's what a Panther woman wants to hear.
That was Jamal Joseph, author of Panther Baby, and I'm Mark Steiner. We have to take a very short break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll hear more from Jamal Joseph. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Today we're listening to an interview I did with Jamal Joseph at the Enoch Pratfee Library during this year's City Lit Festival. Jamal Joseph is a former Black Panther and is an associate professor and former chair of Columbia University's Graduate Film Division and the artistic director of the New Heritage Theater in Harlem. He's also the author of the recently published memoir called Panther Baby.
Now, Ma Baltimore, you mentioned some of the Panther art, Emery Douglas's, you know, art, which showed the police
right.
as pigs, and had liberation posters that would show African school children with books on one shoulder and an AK-47 on another shoulder. Well, Ma goes to clean up my room after telling me for weeks, clean up your room, and I'm too busy now because school, karate, the Panthers, I'm on the go. And she finds hidden under my bed all of this Black Panther material. So I come home late one night from a Panther meeting. I told her it was after school center, and there stacked up is all the Panther literature and Holy Bible and a belt. That was the mafia altar. She said, boy, what is this? And I said, Grandma, you was in my room. She said, stop it. Don't even. She says, because I read through some of this stuff, and boy, I don't know if you've lost your mind, and I don't know if I should bless you with this belt or kill you with this Bible. But you are not going back. And I begged and pleaded. And when I went by the Panther office to say why I couldn't come back anymore, I said, my grandmother's an Uncle Tom, and she's tripping. And Afeni, Tupac's mom, almost took my head off. She said, never speak about your grandmother this way. She said, because she's the reason why you're here. And I mean literally, because we stand on the shoulders of people like your grandmother, number one. And number two, you weren't open and honest with her, and she's just protecting you the best way she knows how. Yewa said, let me go talk to her. And Yewa comes to the house and beautifully convinces my grandmother, like, if you don't let him go back, that's one thing, but let me keep an eye on him. I'll make sure that he gets to school on time, that he does his homework, that he obeys you. I'll keep an eye on him. And she really detected a sense of concern from this strong man before her, and so she let me go back. Well, 4 weeks later, the cops kick in the door, and I'm arrested as part of the Panther 21 case, the same case of Feeney was arrested on. And it was the entire leadership of New York, and even though I had just turned 16, I was head of the youth cadres in the high schools. And we were charged with conspiracy to possess weapons. They said that we were going to bomb the botanical gardens. You know, the Panthers really hated flowers. They said we were going to bomb the botanical gardens. And we were facing a sentence that was 300-plus years. And at first we thought the charges were a joke. And then we found out that there were two undercover cops, part of an elite police unit, that had infiltrated the Panthers and that had fabricated all of this evidence. One was a guy named Gene Roberts, who had been Malcolm X's bodyguard, who literally was on stage when Malcolm X was shot a few feet away. In fact, you can go Google the photo, and you'll see an image of Gene Roberts giving Malcolm X mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Malcolm drew his last breath from an undercover cop. No one knew it. He was a loyal follower of Malcolm. He was one of them. He then left and joined the Panthers, and the other one was Yewa, my mentor, the guy who taught me hand-to-hand combat, who taught me how to make pancakes, who came to my grandmother's house and convinced her to let me stay, was an undercover cop.
And you see, that was the time as well. I mean, here you were, you were in jail. You spent 13 months in jail waiting for trial and got out because you were young. But this was something that was very common. I mean, the infiltration of the Black Panther Party, of that kind of this kind of agent provocateurs going in and kind of exploding it out and having people arrested, and the Panther 21 and what they went through. Innocent of the charges they were accused of, but either had to languish in prison, wait this trial, and destroy the organization from the inside out. That's what was happening at the moment.
And it was known as the counterintelligence program, as a well-coordinated effort that was led by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, called COINTELPRO, that stood for the counterintelligence program. And it was meant to operate exactly the way that you described it, to destroy an organization from the inside and from the outside, to have people infiltrate the organization, create rifts and bad blood within the organization, plant false evidence or push members to do things that they wouldn't normally do, and then criminalize the movement. Now, why you want to do that is because in the public's eye, you want to not only destroy the movement, but criminalize the movement. This led to the death of so many people. And I like to say also to the death of police officers, because the FBI did the same thing to local police departments, where they would go to a local police department and say, the Panthers are planning to attack you. You need to do a preemptive strike. Whereas there may not have been quite that level of hostility between a local police department and that local chapter of the Black Panther Party, the FBI would make sure that there was, and there would be these raids that happened across the country, where in Philadelphia, for example, Panther office was raided, Panthers were stripped naked and made to stand out in the cold, handcuffed and chained for about 10 hours. In Los Angeles, there was a shootout between Panthers and the local police. In Ohio, the Panther office was bombed. And in Chicago, Fred Hampton was murdered in his sleep, unarmed, murdered in his sleep when they raided the apartment.
So we always say to the Black Panther Party that they can do anything they want to us. We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary.
What happened in Fred Hampton's case is an example. I want to bring it back to the Panther 21 in just a second. Is, I think, indicative of how people of conscience, progressive people of all colors, began to question what the government was doing to the Panther Party. A young reporter, the Panthers left the apartment open, and they said, come see what happened. And it was similar to what had happened in Chicago a dozen years earlier with Emmett Till, where Emmett Till, who had gone to Mississippi and had been brutally murdered, his crime was flirting with a white woman. I think he whistled at a woman behind the counter. Later, her husband and some other men came and took young man out of bed, killed him, and left his body in the river, where he was mutilated beyond recognition. His mother bravely said, leave the casket open. I want the world to see what happened to my son so that it doesn't happen to anyone else. And 50,000 Chicagoans, black and white, came to see. And it became lead stories in all of the black press, much of the white press, and people became outraged that this thing could happen in 55 or 56. The Panthers left that apartment open in Chicago, and people came through to see the bloody sheets, to see the bullet holes, and a young white reporter looked at the bullet holes and said, if this was such a fierce shootout, how come all the bullets are traveling from outside to inside? And again, you don't have to be a forensic scientist to know that a bullet goes in small and comes out big. And people investigated it. It became, the citizens of Chicago became outraged. Years later, there was a lawsuit that was settled where millions of dollars were paid to the survivors. But more importantly, then people began to say, it doesn't matter what the Panthers' politics are. We may not agree with that. They're a Marxist organization. They're talking about revolution. But they do not deserve to be murdered in their sleep. And then people came to the Panther 21 says, we may not agree with the politics of the New York Black Panther Party, but they don't deserve to be in jail with bail that is $100,000 when they're students, artists, community organizers. And I was surprised going to court one day as a young Panthers to see that the NAACP had sent their lawyers from the Legal Defense Fund to argue the question of bail and to argue the question of us getting a jury by our peer group. And that's why I think the lesson in the 60s that the Panthers helped people of conscience come together, maybe not around all of the issues that the Panthers talked about, but around the issues of the breakfast program, which was poverty, yes? Healthcare, which was the free health clinics that the Panthers started, the issue of bail and fair trials. Law students would come out just around those issues to make us understand that democracy works when citizens always question and have a militant voice about what's going on in government.
So read the Communist Manifesto. Guerrillas in the mix, the Guevara and Manesto. So
what a brother with an afro now.
Yo, go a blow for the Mac and we the hoes. So grow, cause the Lucian brothers might get hung. Rhetoric flowing from the tip of my mouth. Say tongue deficit.
Money spit.
Catch the glint.
Oh my nine, as they cut welfare 25%.
And I dissent as I flinch and raise my
we
fist.
We did away with that.
So you could get with this. It's a twist cause we'll overthrow like Kwame Nkrumah. Spread around the world as if it were a vicious rumor. Bam, cuts a record like a surgeon cuts a tumor from a
boy. So I really like to jump into, because I want people to get a sense of this, what else is in the book. What happened to you? The Panthers were decimated and destroyed by this, by these raids and these trials. Panther 21, even though they were let off, it caused a split inside the Panthers. Organization was falling apart. You had to go underground yourself as a Panther 21. And you can tell the story from there, picking up how you took on drug dealers and tried in the community, and you ended up in prison for a long time.
Yes.
You got a 12-year sentence.
Yes.
So to give a piece of that story, I want people to hear that part of what happened to you and what happened to the Panthers inside. Say it's that part of your...
When I got to Leavenworth to do what was going to be the long sentence, the first day there I met an older prisoner who gave me an amazing piece of advice. It was life-changing advice. And it was simple, as most good pieces of advice are. He said, young blood, you can serve this here time, or you can let this here time serve you. And like a light bulb, it went off that I had to really read and better myself and try to understand where I had come in life and where I was. Malcolm had another great quote that said, the penitentiary has been the university for many a black man. So I began taking college courses. At that time, KU, University of Kansas, had an amazing program where professors would come in every night. You would sign up.
That's when you were in federal prison. You've been convicted. You're doing time now.
I'm doing federal time.
You had a 12-year sentence.
I had a 12-year sentence. Right. And professors would come in. And the dedication of these, and it planted the seed for me to want to be an educator, because the dedication of these professors who were coming in were really quite amazing. And one of the professors I like to talk about is Professor Johnson, who is this petite woman, English professor, in her late 60s, who stood about 5'3", who was like the toughest person in the joint, seriously. She would come, and if you did an English paper and it wasn't right, she would mark it up, and she'd hand it back. And look, guys are there doing 25 years, 50 years, life, bank robbery, kidnapping, and she'd hand the paper back. I know you can do better than this, Mark. And you see this big, tough convict with Professor Johnson. I tried, and it's not enough. And one day she brought in the Bible, She brought in the Holy Bible and had redlined it with grammatical errors. She said, look at what I found. I don't care what you're convicted of. We were sitting in the back of the classroom like, yo, man, she's redlining Jesus, man. She's no joke. There was one guy in our class, man, Big Bo. I mean, he was doing like a double life sentence, could knock you out with one punch, you know, baddest guy in the joint. And Big Bo standing in the yard like looking really down. And we dared to approach him. Bo, you all right? I'm all right, man. Bo, everything all right? Man, you get some bad news from home? We knew his mother was struggling. She had cancer. Nah, man, you know, mom's all right, man. We knew he was going to the parole board. Big Bo, something bad happened to the parole board? They hit you with another 10 years? Nah, man, you know, I ain't see the board yet. What's the matter, Bo? Oh, man, I'm going to tell you, right? Professor Johnson, man, she gave me a C. That's going to mess up my whole GPA, man. So it was kind of wonderful in a couple of ways of seeing that dedication, of seeing when you come with love, right, and you come with high expectation that you can walk without fear, which is how our professors came in, and we loved them. And we weren't great. They weren't safe because the guards weren't going to let anything happen to them. We weren't going to let anything happen to us. They recognized excellence or the potential within us. And the second thing that happened is Mr. Cody, the same guy, came to me, and he found out that I had done some theater. I had been part of the Black Arts Movement and done some poetry and done some theater. And he came to me. He was like, yo, young blood, do something for Black History Month, and just kind of walked away. And the way he said it, I knew this like wasn't a request. I needed
you had
to
do this.
I had to do this. So I went to the library. There was no black plays in the library. I wrote a play. And now prison is it is highly segregated. Men segregate themselves. Black prisoners stay in one section, Latino, white prisoners, and there's tough gangs associated with each section, the Black Guerrilla Family, the Aryan Brotherhood, the Mexican Mafia. And they never, you know, unless it's some business in a neutral area like gambling or drugs, people never sit together. They never socialize. So I'm in doing, trying to teach two of my actors, you know, how to act, and it was very funny. I'm teaching through improv. So I go, freeze, guys, that was good, you know? Big Death, Big Black, that was great, man. You guys were talking about, you said you're going to stab him. You said you're going to, like, crush his. That was good. That was a good improv, you know, and that was dialogue. That was good. You guys just did dialogue. Say that with me. And Big Black, well, I wasn't dialoguing. I don't like him. I'm going to kill him. No, stop, guys. All right. Work with me. Breathe. You're a tree. Come on, let's relax. Put your arms up. Breathe. And at that very moment, the two guys from La M.A., the Mexican Mafia, the leaders, these guys had gotten more life sentences on top of life sentences because they'd killed three or four guys since they'd been in the joint. They come in and they're diesel from the weight pile, tattoos, and they're watching like they're really upset. Now, all of us are trying to play it cool, right, because you can't show fear, but all of us have the same thought. They have left their court, their section of the prison. Who are they here to kill? And after about 10 minutes, the leader, Rafael, looks at me. Tito looks over at me, and he was like, yo, S.A., let me speak to you a minute. And I went, damn, it's me. See, I knew doing theater was like violated the convict code. I knew this could be, okay, just be man to man, Jamal. Just look him in the eye. You know, don't show any fear. And he pulls me to the side and he was like, S.A., man, there's been rumors about you in the joint. And I had to come here and see for myself. And I've been sitting here for about 10 minutes and I'm going to tell you something, S.A. That guy you're working with, S.A., that effing guy, your homes, he's not feeling his character. True story. So he gets involved. Then some of the white guys come to see what the blacks and Mexicans are
and
doing.
Leonard
they
Peltier.
Get involved. Huh?
And Leonard Peltier.
And Leonard Peltier. The great Leonard Peltier comes. And for those of you who don't know, Native American freedom fighter, Leonard Peltier. And we form a multicultural group within the prison. We have our own courtyard. And that became life-changing because I started to see the power of the creative arts for the ability to bring people together and to transform lives through people telling their stories.
For the love of revolution, for the life that I lead, es por eso que yo, yeah, por la familia que yo quiero, for my beautiful niece, es por eso que yo, yeah, for the future of the youth that remind me of me, es por eso que yo, yeah, para Chile, for Chicago, for the kids on Halsey, es por eso que yo, yo. I dedicate this to them kids that remind me of me. Those rebellious that I call MCs. It's them
so,
kids on the corners.
I think it's important to hear that. One of the things you talk about in this book a lot is the power of what it means to be a revolutionary. Whether it was being a Panther and a revolutionary, studying Marx, studying Fanon, studying all the great revolutionary leaders, learning how to fire a gun. But then things changed. And as you did your time in prison, and went through college in prison, and by that, when you were arrested, just put it real shortly, when you were arrested, you were already married, had this lovely wife, had a kid, when they broke down your door and took you away, put you in prison, that when you came out, there was something that happened to you where you never stopped calling yourself a revolutionary, but there's something transformative about the way you approach what it means to be a revolutionary. Just talk a bit about that. That's another piece of the sense. So we can't get through a really detailed book, unfortunately, which we could at least.
Absolutely.
Let's get to this point.
Well, I started working small college as a counselor, recruitment counselor, and then the director of student activities. And I was doing some theater and working with some young people. But the thing that really happened that transformed me was that a young man who grew up in our building named Andre, a good kid, went out to a party one night and got hit by a stray bullet. And when I came back that night, when I came home, his mom was in the street crying. She got the news late at night, but she couldn't stay inside. The apartment was too small to contain her grief. And my wife and the other women from our building and the women in the community were consoling her and crying. This was a good kid who was 14 years old. And we men in the community were standing a few feet away watching the women cry. And at that very moment, this was in the late 90s in Harlem, I looked and I had an almost out-of-body experience where I said, this is Harlem, 1997. This could very well be Mississippi, 1857. Or this could be South Africa, 1947, where the men are watching the women cry over the death of another child. I have got to do something right here where I live in Harlem. And my wife and I came together with another friend, Voza Rivers, who produced Serafino on Broadway. And with just a few dollars that we scraped together, we started a program. Oh, the context is that there's a crack epidemic. Giuliani is the mayor, and he's throwing lots of money at the police and stripping away money from community centers, after-school programs, arts programs don't exist.
Everywhere in America.
Sports program, right. Everywhere. It's cut down. And I knew from prison what art could do to save lives. And we started with no money, no resources. In fact, my wife reminded me that even though we had money, she reminded me about how the Panthers started the breakfast program by knocking on doors and asking for food, by knocking on other doors and asking churches and community centers, could we use the kitchen, by mimeographing some flyers and putting them up and, you know, getting kids to come out to feed them. And we started Impact Repertory Theater, which has a model of combining creative arts with leadership training in an environment where kids are empowered because they're telling their stories through music, dance, and drama, and then going out to the community, to schools, to community centers, to theaters to perform.
Let's wrap it up here. We'll
okay.
So, because you'll be signing books downstairs, right?
What happens
next?
Yes. Sounds right.
Correct.
And more questions. I guess questions that we can't answer.
Maybe we'll take one or two quick questions.
My favorite crux question. MLK versus Malcolm X, Frantz Fanon versus Howard Zinn, nonviolence, violence. I think about it all the time. I juggle those two balls. What's your deepest thinking? You are a man of wisdom.
Deepest thinking is a quote from Bobby Seale, just to keep the answer short. Bobby Seale said that when the Panthers started in 66, they carried shotguns and law books because those were the dynamic weapons of social change. If the Panthers were started today, he and Huey would still have Panthers out on the street, patrolling the street, doing community programs, doing all of that work, but that Panthers would be carrying video cameras and laptop computers because these are the dynamic weapons of social change.
So, well, we have time for one quick question.
Okay. Listen, I was in Chicago. I was born back in 1958, so you can pretty much get an idea of what was going on in Chicago.
Absolutely.
Let me get to my question. I understand, I got by hearsay that the gangs that were in Chicago, they were the Black Peace Stone Nation.
Exactly.
And the Disciples, the Gangster Disciples.
The Gangster Disciples, the Peace Stone Nation, and the Young Lords.
Right, the Vice Lords over on the West.
Yeah, they were the Vice Lords who became the Young Lords because of Fred Hampton.
Right, right. See, I was I was knee-high to a chicken. Right. So everything that I heard was pretty much hearsay.
Yeah.
All right, and I do like actual fact.
Sure.
I understand that it was supposed to be a meeting that was supposed to go on in Soldiers Field, that you guys were trying to bring these brothers together
and
inform them on accurate knowledge. Can you give me some sort of idea of how they broke that down? What happened?
Sure. And this is exactly why Fred Hampton was killed, by the way, because he was having great success. Fred Hampton was an amazing speaker. Please Google Fred Hampton. You see some of his speeches. He had that combination of the Black church style along with that revolutionary style, and he was a very effective communicator, even more effective on the ground organizer. He was 21 years old when he was killed. He was 18 when he joined the Panthers and had been a field organizer for the NAACP, and he was very effectively getting gang members to put their guns down, to stop shooting each other, and to become revolutionary forces within their communities, to do community programs. The most successful example was the Vice Lords that became the Young Lords, that produced people like Felipe Luciano and Pablo Guzman and, you know, all of these great leaders in the Puerto Rican community. And the same thing was happening with the Disciples and with the Peace Stone Nation. And Chicago said, listen, how's this going to work? We have 35, maybe 40,000 police officers. There's 150,000 gang members. If they all become political like the Panthers want, we've lost this city. And that's why Fred Hampton was assassinated.
Well, I want to thank you, for coming out today. This has been amazing. Thank Jamal you. Joseph, the book Panther Baby.
Thank you.
We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll listen to a panel discussion that we did at UMBC on race and the civil rights movement in music and media.
For ourselves, we're tired of beating our head against the wall and working with someone else.